From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, police and murder in South Carolina. Iran talks back on the deal. Rand Paul will run a marathon bombing verdict. A bystander filmed the policeman shooting in South Carolina, the black man running away. Officer Michael Slagle charged with murder. North Charleston Police Chief Eddie Driggers.
I have watched the video, and I was sickened by what I saw.
Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul is formally in the race for the White House.
The Washington machine that gobbles up our freedoms and invades every nook and cranny of our lives must be stopped.
And a verdict for Johar Tsarnaev in the Boston Marathon bombing. Against the sound of race day turned tragedy 2 years ago, NBC's Pete Williams reported the jury's decision.
Jurors declared a 21-year-old Chechen immigrant guilty of the worst act of terrorism in the United States since 9/11.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Ron Allen of NBC News, Robert Costa of The Washington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Does the dash cam video change your view of the South Carolina shooting? Do you see murder? And what about Rand Paul? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Newark, New Jersey, at Ron Allen, national news correspondent for NBC News, former foreign correspondent, covered Iraq and Afghanistan, Panama, Central America, and much more. He's back from Ferguson, Missouri this week. Ron Allen, welcome back to On Point. Glad to have you.
Nice to be here. Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, and with us from Washington, Robert Costa, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Robert Costa, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom. A pleasure as always.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Ron, and Robert.
Here was the mayor of North Charleston, Keith Summey, announcing that Officer Michael Slager had been arrested and charged in the fatal shooting, everybody's seen it now, of Walter Scott.
I can tell you that as the result of that video and the bad decision made by our officer, he will be charged with murder.
That was Tuesday. Yesterday, we saw the dash cam video. South Carolina Law Enforcement Division released it. The interaction between Walter Scott and Officer Michael Slager moments before Scott made a dash from his parked Mercedes with a police car behind it. Slager pursued and ultimately, as we've all seen in that video, shot him in the back as he ran away. Audio is a little hard to understand, but the beginning of the conversation is calm, as Scott says that he hasn't yet bought the car he's driving, so he doesn't have the paperwork for it.
You don't have any paperwork in the glove box? No registration in there? No insurance?
He has all that stuff.
What is it? Okay. But you're buying the car?
Yes, sir.
Did you already buy it?
No, not yet. I'm about to buy it.
Okay, it's a minute ago you told me that you bought it.
Well,
and you're changing everything over on Monday.
I'm sorry about that.
Slager goes back to his car. Scott makes a dash from his Mercedes, and we've seen what happens then behind the pawn shop. The unbelievable video of the officer apparently coolly gunning down a 50-year-old man who is trying to get away. Ron Allen, does what we hear in the dash cam video audio there change this story? Does it complicate it or not, Ron?
I think it raises the question of what happens between that dash cam video and the video shot by Mr. Santana, the bystander. But it's really hard to explain an officer shooting at a man who's running away, who's several yards away from him, and by most accounts and common sense seems to be posing no threat. He's running away. It's just unbelievable that that sort of thing would happen. And I think the biggest question that this raises is, one of the biggest questions is, how often does this happen? You know, we see these things on videotape. Is it happening more, or is it that there's more videotape of it? And this is one of the things that hangs over this. There's no national database, no watchdog that counts how often unarmed or armed suspects, minorities, are shot, killed, wounded by police. So perception fuels this very emotional and passionate debate, and we just don't know. But how do you justify shooting at a man who clearly is running away?
Robert Costa, how does this video and this killing and these murder charges, how does all of this come into the national conversation, which has been so hot since Ferguson and all the rest? This video, 8 shots fired. The officer so cool and a kind of, I'm not inside his head, I'm not a judge and jury, but a kind of nonchalance, I mean, like shooting down a dog. It's just terrible to watch. How does this hit the national conversation, Robert?
It's a fascinating question, and I've spoken to several advisors to Republican presidential campaigns, and I said, what does this mean for you as you move ahead, and perhaps for Secretary Clinton as she enters the race? And their answer has been almost universal, that they thought this was going to be a foreign policy election, election about the Islamic State and talking about different issues abroad. But domestically, instead of having debates over taxes or something like Social Security or the Affordable Care Act, it's really about the race issues in this country, the controversy in Ferguson, what's happened this week. And I think that is animating the internal discussions of these political campaigns. And it's going to trickle out into the national conversation when they start to hit the campaign trail.
The incredible courage of this guy Santana, who stood, I guess, behind a fence, maybe in bushes. I don't know what, but he stood there and kept filming this, even when that looked like a very, very potentially dangerous thing to do. Rally in North Charleston on Wednesday, Black Lives Matter rally. Here was Muhyiddin Dabaya saying it's time for police violence to end.
A police culture has existed for a long time in which an officer can feel comfortable, shooting somebody 8 times in the back.
Jack, you can wish that Walter Scott had not jumped out of his car, had not run away. On the other hand, none of us know the whole story. There's that gap in the middle here between the car and what we saw behind the pawn shop. But when you look at that video of the officer coolly gunning him down, it's the most disturbing thing I've seen in a long time, Jack.
It is. And the question is, what do we see there? You know, according to research by ProPublica, black males are 21 times more likely to be killed by police than white males. Well, why is that? Well, one reason, given just last night by a black candidate for mayor in Philadelphia, Doug Oliver, is he said the sad truth is police have good reason to be afraid of black men. He pointed to the higher crime rates there. Well, that's one answer. Another answer came from a civil rights lawyer who interviewed 900 Los Angeles area policemen in the course of her work, and she found really almost sort of prehistoric, elemental fear of black men in these policemen. They just seem to be haunted by this, you could call it racist or you could call it American, fear of the other, all that embodied in black men. And the question is, between the justified fear and this irrational fear, or at least this you know, visceral fear that police have, and it leads them, by the way, according to tests, to overestimate the age of black children. They think they're older than they are, and so on. Between these two factors, what could be done? Well, I think the Times got at some of that this week when they pointed out that the race gap in American policing. I mean, North Charleston, the police department, 42% more white than the community. But nearby Charleston, or adjoining Charleston, only 6% more than the community. Well, what is Charleston doing with its more integrated force that North Charleston isn't, and isn't? Isn't that the beginning to make police forces look like the communities they serve and to humanize African-American men to white policemen?
You know, I have to say, Jack, what I saw in that video was not fear. I saw something look more like entitlement. Now, there could have been ambient fear, but as he did that, it looked like this is the way things roll. And this man has offended me. And now he wasn't threatened. The man was running away. I mean, Ron Allen, did you see a frightened policeman there?
No, and this whole notion of justified fear, I find troubling. Police officers are professionals. They're supposed to be trained. They're not supposed to be afraid while they're doing what they do. Yes, they're human beings, and yes, they certainly want to go home every night to their wives and husbands and kids, I accept that. But this is justifiable fear, and no, I don't see fear in that. I see entitlement. I see retribution, so on, all that. And you're right. The answer to this question is this whole notion of community-based policing, to some extent, of police representing and being from the communities that they protect and serve. You know, the optimal situation would be the officer lives down the street and patrols that block. But of course, that's not realistic given a lot of economics and so on and so forth in America. But that's got to be the goal, that police are the people, they live in the community, they know the community, they should be, in some communities they've moved to residency requirements.
I don't see why that's unrealistic, Ron, to have the policeman live down the block.
Believe me, I think it's a great goal, but the realities of it are such that in some communities, poor communities, for example, communities where there's not a strong education system, there aren't people at times who meet the qualifications to be a police officer. For example, in St. Louis, they're doing a recruitment effort to try and get more minority officers into the police force in St. Louis next to Ferguson. One issue that came up is that there are the pool of applicants, there are a lot of people who have criminal records, for example, that disqualifies them. So do you change the requirements? Perhaps you increase the pool. What about the educational requirements?
Yeah.
You don't want to get people into these police forces who don't qualify, but you have to think about the realities of the places that are being policed. And yes, there are high crime rates in some African-American and some Hispanic and some poor white communities. But again, the situation is that these officers have to be a part of the community. They have to not just hand out tickets. They have to coach little league teams. They should be teachers in the after school programs. They should be volunteers on Sunday and after churches.
Sounds great. Hard to get to. Robert Costa, just half a minute before the break here. But can you see this flowing into the heart of the 2016 campaign? It has been so hot for the last year and more now, this issue, Robert.
It is going to, and you get this perspective from both Democrats and Republicans because they thought on domestic policy the rising gap between the rich and the poor would be a central issue. But now perhaps it's between black and white. It's between ethnic minorities and police officers around the country. This has brought it to the fore.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a week in the news. Police murder charge in South Carolina, marathon bombing verdict, Ron talking back on the nuclear deal, Rand Paul saying he'll run, and a lot more. Ron Allen is with us from NBC News, Robert Costa from The Washington Post. Jack Beatty's here. You can join us. Do you see murder in South Carolina? Are you ready to take America back with Rand Paul? And what does that mean to you, take America back? Do we have a firm deal with Iran? Lots of feedback online here. Ziad says, Slager, the officer in North Charleston, could have aimed at his legs if he had any in-the-moment appreciation of a human being's life. Want him so bad? Aim it at the legs. Josh says, it really doesn't matter what happened before the video taken by Santana. Officers do not have the right to use deadly force on a fleeing suspect unless they feel endangered or others endangered by that. Sure didn't look like that. Let's go to Dean calling from Norman, Oklahoma. Dean, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I was just going to comment on the Slager issue. Me being a minority, I'm Native American, which is a little bit bigger in the Oklahoma area.
Yep.
But my dad was Department of Corrections for about 20 years, so I actually have a little bit more of an insight on it. Running from the car actually means the officer is always going to chase after the suspect.
Sure.
However, there is no point in which firing 8 shots is going to be non-lethal. They have better training than that. And I agree with the previous commenters that he could have shot at the leg. I even think he could have fired a warning shot to say, you need to stop or else something bad is going to happen. None of that was done. You can't tell, at least, none of that was done on any of the videotapes. So I do actually feel that murder is probably going to be a justifiable charge. I fear, however, that it's not going to stick because there's going to be too many people opposed to it saying that he just fired in the line of duty.
I mean, without the video, it seems, no one knows, but that is almost always what happens. But we do have the video here. Dina, I appreciate your call. Ron Allen, very few shots hitting above the belt here. I mean, in the back, below the belt, in the back, in the ear, something in the buttock. But what about, I mean, if all he wanted to do was stop this man, surely officers are trained to shoot to that end instead of death.
As I understand it, police officers are trained to shoot at the biggest mass, which is the chest back area. And also,
no matter what, it's a traffic stop. The guy had a taillight out.
Well, and remember, most police officers never shoot their weapons, and most police officers, it's remarkable. I mean, he's a very good shot because my understanding of it is that a lot of police officers never fire their guns and don't hit their targets. There's a lot of stray bullets out there in the world. So that he hit this guy is pretty remarkable in and of itself. You know, the other interesting part about this is where the officer apparently goes and moves the taser back towards the victim, and appears to be planting evidence, which of course plays into the complaint, the grievance that you hear in so many communities that they planted the gun on me. And that's the other part of this thing that's really troubling to a lot of people looking at this, the fact that the officer apparently is trying to stage the situation. And, you know, you hear so many people out there, activists saying, see, we told you so. This is what always happens. And now you see it on tape. So now will you believe us going forward?
Looking so cool about it. Myla in Providence, Rhode Island. Myla, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Tom, thanks for taking my call. Yes. And to answer your question, the video of the dash cam doesn't change my view. What bothers me about this case is this guy shot somebody who's laying down on the ground. Casually, this guy didn't even attempt to help him, CPR or anyone, until somebody else comes, at least from what I saw.
He put the cuffs on him, but he doesn't appear to have done CPR. Yeah.
Correct. Then the other thing that I want to know that I haven't got from any news media is, did the officer give an explanation as to why he shot him before the video came out, in terms of did he lie as the reason why this guy was gunned down?
Well, I mean, on the radio, he's saying that there was a struggle over the taser. I mean, it's not a full explanation. Given what he's saying and what we're seeing, there seems to be plenty of reason to be very skeptical here. I assume a bunch of this will not come out until the trial, but surely there are plenty of inconsistencies already just plain obvious here. Myla, I appreciate your call. Let me get one from South Carolina. Columbia, Sharon, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And hello to your guest. Tom, I'm a diversity awareness consultant, and I've reached out to North Charleston's Police Department, a Sergeant Glover, and a Spencer Pryor, who's over public relations, and I'm hopeful that they'll give me a call back. I'm particularly interested in working with the police department about cultural awareness, diversity, and sensitivity training. South Carolina has had a history. You know about our history.
Sure.
And the community wants to heal. I'm from the faction that the community wants to heal, and what we can do to start the healing process. It might be too soon now. Those officers need training. They need to know how to work in their communities and how to be not so much sympathetic, but, you know, how do you police a community where the majority of the community folks, the residents, are African American?
Yeah, but Sharon, you know, we do know North Charleston had a very high crime rate, and it has come down in recent years, the reporting I've read has said, and in part because they've had aggressive policing. But within that, how do you root out this readiness to do what we saw on that video? Even if you're going to be tough, you can't be murdering.
Tom, you can't be murdering, but everybody, police officers, I can't get into their head as to how they respond when they feel that their life is on the line.
Who said his life did not appear at all to be on the line? A 50-year-old man was running away from him. Sharon, I appreciate your call. One more right here. Mario in Boston. You're on the air, Mario.
Hi, Tom. This is Mario calling from Boston.
Hi.
And my comment, Tom, is, you know, as a Hispanic male, I can understand the scrutiny that sometimes we receive from police officers. But, you know, my comment is, I think what happened after Ferguson, I thought it would have been prudent for many towns across America to let their police officers know that with some of the events that have been occurring, you know, is it time for a sense of training? Is it time for a sense of integrating the police more with communities? Because, you know, the police, they've taken a bash this past summer. And, you know, I understand, you know, we need the police. I think they're in a no-win situation. But, you know, I just think that, you know, many police chiefs and mayors would have said, you know, we need to really do something and put a dent in this so that we can basically take away the blow we've been receiving for public perception. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, and maybe change operations and try to change mindsets. Robert Costa, that is one thing that really struck me about this video. This is months and months after Ferguson, after everything we saw with Eric Garner in New York and the things in Ohio and Ferguson again and again, that a policeman in North Charleston would still feel this kind of latitude to pull that pistol out and shoot down a fleeing man. It's like, how could the Ferguson message be so missed here? How deeply embedded is that sense of what? Some kind of strange entitlement, Robert?
Your caller brought up a great point, which is, where is the awareness here among a lot of these police officers? I come from a family of police officers. My father was a police officer in Washington, D.C.
Yep.
And I deep respect for the force. But that does not mean you tune out from the news. And I think we're going to see politicians, local leaders, national leaders really start to wonder, how do we get more people in law enforcement, whether in a local municipality or in a big city, in touch with what's happening in the country and how people are really concerned about conduct and actions taken by the police?
Let's go to Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, you're on the air.
You know, this myth that police are fearful of black people, of black men in particular, it always have bothered me a little bit, because for the majority of the news reports that I see, when a police officer is shot, it tends to be always a right-wing white militia guy, and hardly ever it's a black person in America. And that always have bothered me, why they fear me and my kind so much when we're not the ones that's shooting them.
What do you see in the video this time, Carl?
I see in the video a murder. There's absolutely no doubt about it. And if it wasn't for the video, the officer that we're talking about, he would have a GoFundMe page probably worth about $200,000 right now, unfortunately.
You mean people actually supporting him?
People would support him because they use the same... It's like a script that a police officer used when they shoot and kill someone. He was reaching for my gun. I was in fear for my life. I mean, it's like a universal script. And unfortunately, more often than not, here in America, the dominant race, which is the white race, they tend to believe in the officer than to believe in the black dead guy.
Well, body cameras or not, there are a lot of cameras out in our society right now, and that is part of the reason that we're beginning to see more of what formerly might have been invisible. Appreciate your call, Carl. Bobby in South Carolina. Denmark, South Carolina. Bobby, you're on.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Okay, what do you see?
The deference that we give to authority figures, I have always been a proponent of questioning these authorities for our, I guess, my adult life. We've been socialized to give deference to police officers and chiefs of police and mayors and folks in authority positions. And we've been telling people that these folks are not operating on a fair playing field with the community. But without any evidence of that, you know, i.e.
Yep.
a video,
yep.
That officer would have been back on the street.
Yeah, but Bobby, let me ask you, Bobby, you say deference, but Walter Scott got out of his car and ran from the policeman when the policeman was very clear in what he was asking him to wait while he checked on his registration. That part wasn't deference.
Hey, I'm a former police officer,
mm-hmm.
7 years as, on the street, and I would tell you that once that young man jumped out that car, that 50-year-old man, still young, jumped out that car and started running.
Yeah.
I would have chased them, but I would have never pulled that level of a force or used that level of force to stop him. I would have tackled him down. He couldn't outrun me.
So how do you interpret what you saw? Why do you think Slager pulled his pistol and shot 8 times?
Listen, I believe there is a culture in some police departments. I'm not going to say all. I'm not even going to say most, but some police departments, there's a culture. Listen. Had this been declared a clean shoot, that officer would have been celebrated in that department. He would have been on the list of the next group of officers that's going to be promoted. He would have gotten the best of training. When the good trainings come out, he would have been on that list to go and get these specialized training to up his pedigree within the department. His upward mobility would have been extremely bright in that department.
Bobby, your perspective opens our ears and opens our eyes, and I appreciate it very much. Let me get one more, if I may, quickly here. Gabriella, thank you, Bobby. Gabriella in Atlanta, Georgia. Gabriella, you're on.
Hello, Tom. I just wanted to share that the video doesn't change my view about police enforcement, especially here in the South, in Georgia, Atlanta, being a white female Hispanic lady. So I have been pulled by the police, and until they see my name and they hear my heavy accent, mm-hmm. They change their attitude, and their question is, are you legal in this country? Just, it has been 2 times that happens. That doesn't change my view about police enforcement. I think that the nation was not ready for a president that is not white, and that created very tense times in the rhetoric that politicians are using against minorities.
we are in a diverse nation now, and we're going to have to bring our policing up to speed with, I mean, we have been for a long time, but never more than now. Gabriella, I appreciate your call from Atlanta as well. We're looking at the week in the news. Bob Costa, maybe this is a moment to turn to Rand Paul. We don't have to lose this subject. It runs under so much in American life. But let me ask you, well, let's listen. Here's Rand Paul announcing his run for the presidency this week in Louisville, Kentucky.
I have a message. A message that is loud and clear and does not mince words. We've come to take our country back.
Bob Costa, what exactly does Rand Paul mean when he says that? We have come to take our country back. Who's we, Kemosabe, and take it back from whom and what?
It's typical Tea Party conservative rhetoric, taking back the country from the liberals in the Obama administration. That's his pitch. But I think we're missing the point a little bit with Rand Paul.
Okay.
Because I think Rand Paul is the most intriguing candidate on these racial issues.
He's reached out a lot.
A lot. He's gone to historically black universities like Howard. He was in Bowie State in Maryland last month.
Mm-hmm.
And in his speech, yes, did he have some Tea Party language? Of course he did. But he also said he wants to focus on criminal justice reform, repealing laws that disproportionately affect black people and minorities.
It's been a long-time theme of his.
And it's something – it's an unusual theme for a major Republican presidential candidate. And he believes that the only way for the Republican Party to win is to expand in 2016. And I think you got to watch him. How does he respond? He's one of the rare politicians who went to Ferguson. Some African-Americans have thought that was exploitative, but he thinks he's reaching out to new voters trying to build the GOP.
Jack Beatty, when Rand Paul says we've come to take our country back, can he limit the take back to social welfare policies that he doesn't like? How's that message resonate?
I really don't know. It's a disturbing locution. I mean, take it back means someone else has it, and we want to restore the status quo. Does that mean before we had a black man president? I just don't know. But you do hear that. I mean, Robert is right. I've seen these Tea Party. That is a trope. It's said again and again. We want to take the country back. In fairness, you know, the Democrats said that when George Bush was in office.
Yeah.
I think Rand Paul, a very interesting candidate. There's no question about it. But I think his big problem is signalized by a headline in today's Foreign Policy: "A dove can't win a hawk fight." You know that he is a year ago, before the rise of ISIS, his candidacy looked a little, looked like it could get some momentum. It wouldn't just simply be a factional
candidacy.
But
he doesn't want American overseas wars if they can be avoided.
Yes, and he's talked about negotiating with Iran. Now he supported that. He's demurred a little bit. He's spoken of reducing military assistance to Israel, and of course now Prime Minister Netanyahu is sort of almost a Reagan-esque figure in the GOP, and you know his views are his general sort of. He even has quoted George Kennan. He said, we need to distinguish between vital and peripheral interests. Well, that's my kind of talk. I love to hear that. But that's not apparently what Republican voters are in the mood for. Their hawkishness is extraordinary. According to a new CBS poll, 86% of them see ISIS as a major threat. That's 25 points higher than Democrats. 72% they're for sending ground troops, 22% higher than Democrats. A plurality of Republicans want force use against Tehran, 25% more than Democrats. On and on. There is a hawkish mood in the GOP, and Rand Paul, with his past views and his present equivocations, is not in line with it.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, March Madness. It's Duke and most outstanding player, Duke freshman Tyus Jones, here with a big three-pointer late in the game that gave the Blue Devils the crown over Wisconsin.
Jones, that's a three. Oh. And Duke's right back in front.
How about this kid?
Freshman out front after Rolling Stone retracted its big UVA gang rape story. The Daily Show's Jon Stewart was incredulous that no one at the magazine was fired.
You know, if nobody else has the guts to do it, I'll fire him. I'm making a citizen's firing. Pack up your desks and give me the number of security there. I'll have them escort you out. How can there be no consequences?
And the handwritten lyrics and notes of Don McLean's song American Pie sold at auction for $1.2 million.
I started singing bye-bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. Them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye and singing, this'll be the day that I die.
So, we're looking at a week in the news. Police murder charge in South Carolina. Marathon bombing verdict. Iran talks back on the deal. Rand Paul will run. And more. You can join us. What do you see on the Iran deal? What do you see out of the Ferguson local vote this week? Kansas and Oklahoma, new abortion restrictions there. On President Obama saying it's wrong to try and convert gays to straight. Talking about new foreign policy approaches with Robert Costa, national political reporter for The Washington Post. Ron Allen, national news correspondent for NBC News. And our own Jack Beatty. Robert Costa, you are quite right. We've all seen it. Rand Paul has tried to broaden his appeal, his outreach with visits, racially diverse and otherwise. But there was this question about temperament and interaction with the press. Maybe this is a vote getter, too. I don't know. But here he was talking on the Today Show with Savannah Guthrie, and it got very testy. She was asking him about several positions on Iran and defense spending and foreign and aid to Israel, where he appeared to have changed his stance. And he jumps in here, strongly objectioning to that line of questioning.
Before we go through a litany of things you say I've changed on, why don't you ask me a question? Have I changed my opinion?
Have you changed your opinion?
That would be sort of a better way to approach an interview.
Okay.
No.
Is Iran still not a threat?
You've editorialized. No. Listen, you've editorialized. Let me answer a question. You ask a question and you say, have your views changed, instead of editorializing and saying my views have changed.
Robert Costa, what's that about? It's not the first time that we've seen Rand Paul really bristle and tussle in that kind of setting. Interpret, please.
This is the real Rand Paul. I've covered him on the campaign trail. I've covered him in Congress for 4 or 5 years. And this is the kind of person he is. He is a combative, brainy, libertarian type Republican who actually enjoys clashing with the press, whether it's a male or female reporter. Anyone who's covered him in Congress can attest to that. However, it's not for a politician who's announced early this week and then gets immediately thrown into these fights with the press. It set the wrong tone in many ways, and even his allies have acknowledged that. And he's not really becoming the top-tier candidate in presentation that I think he hopes to be.
David in Williamstown, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling because Rand Paul has rankled me in the past, but he intrigues me as well. I'm an independent voter. I'm 53 years old, self-employed, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
A year ago or so, I called his office to offer a comment on something and got not the best opinion, but I did go and look at and so that kind of tainted my picture of him, but I like a lot of his views. My point here is that I went and looked at the interview with Savannah Guthrie, and I also heard a program where you had a guest host named John. I can't remember his last name.
Harwood. He had a pretty tough interaction with Rand Paul a year or two ago.
And as much as I find that Rand Paul rankles me, and I actually sent a postcard into your show saying that I thought that your interviewer was a little bit out of bounds on that, when I went to see the interview with Savannah Guthrie, I don't totally... I'm not totally upset with Rand Paul, the editorializing. In other words, I think he definitely has...
Well, she was asking about changes in opinion or stated
right,
view. Is that wrong? Or
don't go and summarize it, though, right out of the box and pigeonhole him so that he has to fight back against 2, 3, 4 assertions about his position. I think he has a point. I'm not saying he's entirely right. I certainly don't think that he should be criticized as picking on women.
That has come up. He responded to that. I heard him just this morning.
Right, your own show, his interview with John would be a case in point where he had a tussle with a man. So anyway, I'll leave it there and hear your responses off air.
David, I appreciate it. Ron Allen, how do you see Ron Paul's resonance across the country?
Well, I work for MSNBC as well as NBC, and I got to tell you that covering Republican candidates over the years, you know, this stuff I think works more to his advantage than to his disadvantage with the base. You know, I hear so many Republican voters out there who are just so against the mainstream media or so critical of us and what we do that when someone like Rand Paul takes on Savannah, I think it's just it's a bounty for him. You know, I listened to that whole thing and I cringed. You know, I felt badly for Savannah. I felt badly for Rand Paul. But I think, you know, it's a good moment for him. And that's, I think, just the way it goes out there in conservative land.
Maybe for primary season. Anita in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Anita, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you, Tom.
Yes.
I have several things I wanted to make. One is, I agree. I don't know who he's pandering to when he says, take back our country. Who is he talking to? Who's the hour? And who are they going to?
Well, he's libertarian, I guess, so you could say it's big government. He doesn't want big government.
Well, I'd like them to be really specific because, to me, Rand Paul used to be more specific about his views. Now he's just pandering and trying to get elected, in my opinion. And another thing is, I think it's dangerous. I think it's dangerous that he vaguely says our and take it back because I think he's pandering to some people who are really just, like, not just conservative, but reactionary and racist. And I don't know, I could be totally wrong. But, you know, I had more respect for him when his views were clearer. I have no respect for him now. I think he's just pandering to reactionary people. And to call President a dove, under President Obama, I'm a dove. I think there's been so many drone strikes under President Obama. I mean, that it's amazing that anyone could call him a dove.
Anita, we've got it, and I appreciate your call very much. One more right here. Thank you, Anita. Michael, you're on.
Yeah, I think Rand Paul is great. He attracts a lot of independent voters, and I think we should make a deal with Iran. And I think he's right on race policy, and I think he's right on too much government. And I think people are threatened by him because they want to define him as a Republican candidate. Lots of independent voters in this country. There are a lot of independent voters, and I'm one of them. I voted for Barack Obama. I'm going to vote for Rand Paul.
Michael, I appreciate your call. There's some running room for Rand Paul. You say the same as Obama on Iran. Let's listen to a little bit of that. This was an interesting week on that front. President Obama talking with New York Times Tom Friedman about nuclear negotiations with Iran. And he seemed to lay out a kind of an Obama doctrine, saying that engaging with countries like Iran, while at the same time guarding core U.S. interests, could work better than sanctions and isolation. He said, we are powerful enough to be able to test these propositions without putting ourselves at risk. Here he is, then continuing.
For us to say, let's try, understanding that we're preserving all our options, that we're not naive, but if in fact we can resolve these issues diplomatically, we are more likely to be safe, more likely to be secure, in a better position to protect our allies. And who knows, Iran may change. If it doesn't, our deterrence capabilities, our military superiority stays in place.
Jack Beatty is at the Obama Doctrine.
Well, he sort of shined to that when Tom Friedman raised it. He said, our defense budget is closer to $600 billion. Iran spends $30 billion. Iran understands they can't fight us. You asked about an Obama doctrine. The doctrine is we will engage but preserve all our capabilities. You know, to me, what was remarkable here is at a time when you know, the headlines and the news is all about the chaos in the Middle East and rampant terrorism and all the rest. The president is speaking almost he's almost raised himself to the historian's level and said, folks, this remains the unipolar moment. The Cold War is over. China has not risen to challenge our hegemony yet. And we are the predominant power in the world. And because we are, we can take risks for peace, for improved relations, without in any way jeopardizing our core interests or reducing our strength. It was a vision of confidence in American, really creativity in foreign policy that I haven't heard from anybody in a long time, where fear has dominated, and people have talked about the United States as if, well, what did Richard Nixon say when about Cambodia? We're talking about a pitiful, helpless giant unless we can invade Cambodia. We're not a pitiful, helpless giant. We're a very strong giant.
Robert Costa, how do you put that up against a lot of criticism out there? Dick Cheney, not least, in recent days, and other Republicans saying, you know, worst foreign policy president ever, putting us in a terrible pickle. Here's Obama saying, no, we're strong, and let's act that way so we don't get engaged in all kinds of trouble down the road.
It's still going to be a tough sell for the president on Capitol Hill. Republicans are now controlling both chambers and in the Senate, which deals with these kind of things. You have Tom Cotton and other hawkish voices really taking a stand against this. You have Bob Corker, the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. He seems more open to discussions with the president, and the president has reached out to him this week. But it's going to be tough, and this is a presidency that has very few strong relationships in Congress. And when he really needs to get his keystone foreign policy piece through, it's going to be difficult.
Stanley in Greensville, South Carolina. Stanley, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Okay.
I prefer that we go for peace before war. War is always should be the last option. And my concern is that I'm a former Marine, and I've served my country. And it is the working class, it's the working poor of this country that fights these wars. The rich of us don't fight wars. Vice President Cheney had multiple deferments to keep him out of Vietnam. Yet my two uncles were drafted to fight in Vietnam. You know, so I believe at the top, these people who are beating the drum for war are pure cowards because they know good and well that their children will never see a military uniform. But it's left on our shoulders to fight these wars. And it's just, I prefer and I support Rand Paul and his ideology reference speaking to Iran, but I'm also want to speak to this issue of 47 senators who got in the bed with the Ayatollah. That if they think that we're going to forget that.
You mean when they wrote saying, don't go for this deal, don't go for this nuclear deal.
That's right. Exactly. You get in the bed with the enemy because there's some hardliners over there in Iran that wants to go to war, too. They love to go to war.
Stanley, our time grows short. I really appreciate your call very much. You're speaking from experience, and we can hear it. We're going to talk more about the view of this deal inside Iran on Monday, but I'm glad for your call today. I've got a little tape here, and thank you, Stanley. This is Iran's President Hassan Rouhani in a televised speech talking about the tentative nuclear agreement. And what he describes about when the sanctions will be lifted, not exactly what John Kerry is telling us, interpreted here by Reuters.
We will not sign any deal unless all economic sanctions are lifted on the same day as the signing of that deal.
Now, there were different translations of this. Someday on the first day of the implementation of the deal, then Ayatollah Ali Khamenei came in saying all sanctions should be removed just when the deal is reached. And he's the supreme leader in Iran, after all. Jack Beatty, do we have a deal with Iran?
Well, we certainly have some objection to it now from high circles in Iran, the one you mentioned, and then also the idea that military sites will be strictly off limits to foreign inspectors. Well, that would include some of the key sites here. And on top of that, the Ayatollah has been, as the Times says, hurling personal insults at the Saudis and especially at the young prince who's their new defense minister and leading the strikes in Yemen, which the Ayatollah calls crime and genocide. Meanwhile, John Kerry is saying we're not going to stand by while the region is destabilized by Iran, which has sent two warships to the area. So it's a very complicated picture. Now, Kerry says the United States can do two things at the same time. We can make a deal with Iran and back Saudi Arabia in its proxy war in Yemen against Iran, which is allied with the Houthis. Well, maybe we can. But it gets things, you know, with Iranian ships in the area now, with planes coming in to support the Houthis, it gets to be a very complicated picture indeed. And you wonder whether this peripheral challenge, really, in Yemen, peripheral to the central issue of nuclear containment, could upset that deal. Certainly, it's going to be another talking point of Republicans.
It may be such a fascinating presidential campaign season with so much hot stuff going on abroad and yet such big concerns at home. Here's Tim writing to us on Facebook, says, with regard to the people saying Clinton and so on, thinking that this election was going to be about foreign policy and ISIS. He writes, if that's what they're thinking, it illustrates how out of touch national politicians are from the domestic problems facing us now. Consolidation of wealth, failing infrastructure, lagging education. Tim writes to us on Facebook, ISIS is the least of my concerns. Boy, that's going to be some interesting tension in this campaign. Jack, I can't go without thinking for a moment here about these 30 guilty counts in the Boston Marathon bombing case. Jahar Tsarnaev now looking at life or death. The jury will decide on sentencing there, a death penalty or otherwise. Are we reaching some kind of insight or resolution here, Jack, a sense of justice?
I just think that the defense may have a strong case here on the venue issue and the issue.
They didn't want it tried in Boston where there was so much emotion.
Yes, yes. In the governing case, it was about Jeffrey Skilling v. United States. The Supreme Court really made it very difficult to switch venues, but they did say that in cases where the news media presents vivid, unforgettable information that we have recognized as likely to produce prejudice, then perhaps you can talk about justifying a new venue. Well,
you mean
my gosh,
this could be thrown out on appeal?
I don't know. I'm just saying it may be, it will be appealed. That will be the ground and the question not of guilt, but of perhaps the death penalty.
Wow. We will be watching that very closely right here above all. Jack Beatty, thank you very much for being with us today. As always, Jack.
Thank you.
Ron Allen, national news correspondent with NBC News, with us today from Newark, New Jersey. Ron, it's always great to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And Robert Costa, national political reporter for The Washington Post. We'll talk more, I hope, Bob, as 2016 comes closer. Thanks for being with us today.
Look forward to it. Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, thanks to all of you. As always, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.